Hi everyone, I'm Chris Hufnagel from the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and it's a real pleasure to be here today. I want to thank you, Scott, for inviting me. This conference is awesome. It's so much fun to come. I live in San Francisco, so I flew in this morning, and I've already run into friends from college because I went to school in Athens here. Yeah. So I'm really happy to be here, and I'm happy that EFF is having a track of events. Electronic Frontier Foundation is a great organization. I'm a member, even though I work for a different organization in the same field. EFF is really on the cutting lines of working on technology and freedom. And I don't know if you've caught it yet, but EFF just released a new DRM guide, electronic media guide, I think on Thursday or Friday, and it's well worth reading. It really shows how iTunes and the various other digital media services out there aren't giving you the thing that you used to get when you went to the store and you bought a CD. You're getting something else. You're getting something, a truncated version of the product you used to receive. And it's that type of great work that Electronic Frontier Foundation does.
Chris, I just wanted to say just for a moment, actually the EF in this particular track comes from Electronic Frontiers Georgia. We have a local group with similar goals to EFF, but it's actually technically independent. So,
excellent.
There was a time in the country when there were a lot of EF type groups. So there was an EF Austin and other EFs, and that's where our EF came from.
Well, good work. And I see you have Anna Lee coming.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great. Definitely worth seeing Anna Lee speak. So I work for a group called Electronic Privacy Information Center. We're Washington-based, although I work in San Francisco on California issues, because California really is the leading state in developing privacy protections. There are about 15 or 16 states that actually have privacy in their constitution. Georgia is one of them. It's one of the reasons why the anti-sodomy statutes here in Georgia were overturned before the federal level, because Georgia has more privacy protection in its constitution than the federal government. California, way back in the 1970s, voted on a proposition to add privacy to their constitution. And as a result, there is a very large penumbra of privacy rights in California that give people advantages that don't exist in other states. For instance, our right to privacy in California applies to the private sector, too. There are certain things that the private sector can't do in California with individuals' data that can happen in other states. What I wanted to talk about today is commercial data brokers. I'm giving a talk again tomorrow. I think actually tomorrow's talk is going to be a lot more interesting. Tomorrow's talk is going to be the how-tos of privacy, how to protect your privacy step by step, and I encourage you to come by for that. It's 11:30 in this room. But for today, I want to talk about a relatively new privacy problem called commercial data brokers. And in my presentation today, basically has three parts. I want to give some background about privacy and what commercial data brokers sell. I'm going to discuss a specific commercial data broker called ChoicePoint. ChoicePoint is actually based here in Georgia. And it is a massive corporation. It's often used as a example of a leading tech firm in the state. And finally, towards the end, I'm going to talk a little bit about how you can try to stay out of these databases if you want to. So with that, let me start off by explaining what we kind of visualize privacy as. Privacy, one of the problems with privacy is that it's used to discuss so many different rights, and so as a result, it's nearly impossible to define. I like to use this definition. It's from Robert Ellis Smith, and the reason why I think it's valuable is because it discusses physical space, the idea that your privacy includes some limit from touching and interference physically from other people. But it also discusses control over personal information, and that is what we are principally concerned with at EPIC. We are trying to give individuals more control over their personal information, and that gives them benefits down the road. People often view privacy from two different angles, one of which is observable. telemarketing is an observable privacy violation. A lot of people don't like telemarketing and say, I don't like it when people invade my privacy, I don't like those telemarketers, or I don't like those spammers, or the people who are sending junk mail. That's all on the side that you can detect, and there's a lot you can do about those forms of privacy invasion. What I'm going to talk about today is a little bit different. I'm going to talk about the information trade. This is a type of privacy, this is a type of involvement in your privacy that you are not often aware of. And the way we try to deal with this invasion of privacy is through fair information practices. One of the principal goals of EPIC, as I like to think we're a sister organization of Electronic Frontiers groups, while the Electronic Frontiers groups often try to use technology to rein in invasive practices, we try to use law. So we litigate, we use the Freedom of Information Act, and we also lobby. I spend a lot of time in, working on legislation in Sacramento and in Washington, D.C. But our goal is to establish fair information practices in law. And the basic principle behind this idea is that entities that collect personal information should have responsibilities. It's not that they can't collect it. It's not that they are cut off forever from collecting their data. It is if they collect it legitimately, they have certain responsibilities, and you have certain rights. Fair information practices are a recognized standard for apportioning those rights. In the United States, we tend not to have many FIPS, but in all across the world, in Western Europe, even in Eastern Europe, in Latin America, and increasingly in Asia, individuals have an interest in their personal information, even when it's collected by another person. And that interest is fair information practices, an ability to limit how their data are used. And so there are three types of information trade, and these are the types of information trade that aren't observable. You don't know about these things unless you're a privacy geek. The first is simply marketing information. There are lots of companies out there that collect your personal information in a lot of different contexts to target market you. And usually this comes in the form of email, direct mail, or telemarketing. This marketing information comes from a lot of different sources. If you use a supermarket shopping cart, that's data that might end up in these databases. Any type of interaction with the government can trigger information in these databases. For instance, I'm working on a case in the 11th Circuit, which encompasses the Southeast, where companies are buying data from the DMV. So you go to the DMV and you get your car and your driver's license. And there are companies that come in and buy the entire data tape from the DMV, including the type of car you own and restrictions, like, for instance, if you wear glasses. And we've just won one of these cases, and we're going to cut down on that data sale a lot. There's some other areas of where marketing information is collected that's pretty deceptive. For instance, when you buy a neat new toy, it comes with a product warranty card, right? You ever fill out that warranty card and send it in? Well, the problem with those warranty cards is they go directly to data brokers. They don't even go to the company that built your toy. And you'll notice that those warranty cards, it's really strange. You know, you buy a hair dryer, and it asks you whether you're married and how much money you make. Well, that's because it has nothing to do with the hair dryer. It's everything to do with collecting information on you that's used for secondary purposes. And the other little dirty trick that not many people know about is that if you call customer service center, and when you give information to the customer service center, let's say you call up a computer support company because your laptop is broken, those computer support companies sell your data. They sell your name, your address, your contact information to companies like Axiom and Experian that later on use this data for marketing. There are two other types of information trade that are very large. One is the consumer reporting industry. Consumer reports are really important in today's economy. They're used for a lot of different purposes. For instance, if you apply to rent an apartment, credit reports are used to make sure that you can pay your rent, to make sure you didn't default on any other landlords. If you apply for a job, your credit report might be pulled. And increasingly, if you have high debt levels, your credit report might be used in the application process, and they might not hire you because if you have high debt levels, you are a risk for embezzlement. Yes, sir.
How would you qualify high debt levels?
Well, it depends on the type of job. Some jobs don't care. And of course, how much debt load you're carrying. I'd say anything over 20,000 is pretty high.
So student loans and things like that.
Student loans aren't as viewed as bad debt. There's bad debt,
credit
card debt is the bad debt. And that's where you, and not all employers will care, but some do. And I'll give you an example. If you apply to be a lawyer in the state of New York, if you have high levels of credit card debt, it's seen that you are an ethics risk. They're concerned that you might steal from a client, and it actually can be a barrier to going on to employment. And, you know, this is a new problem. This type of limit on your employment did not exist 10 years ago because credit reports weren't used in this way. So it's an interesting new problem. Sir, did you have a question?
Can you run down the list of common debt that is not used bad debt?
Student loans and mortgages, secured debt. Automobiles would not be as bad as credit card debt, mainly because your automobile and mortgage debt are secured, whereas the credit card debt is not, and it's tended to be viewed as worse debt. There are a lot of different groups that focus on this issue, one of which is called the PIRG, the Public Interest Research Groups, and they have great resources on figuring out how to deal with that if you are concerned about those issues. Consumer reporting is a really big issue now, and what I wanted to talk about mainly today are data brokers. Data brokers fall outside these two other categories. Data brokers are unregulated, whereas credit reports are heavily regulated by the Fair Credit Reporting Act. You have a statutory right to a free credit report now, for instance. You have a statutory right to dispute inaccurate information on it, to limit the disclosure of your credit report. For instance, if I buy your credit report, it is a civil and criminal offense. I have no business buying it, and so it's protected by statute unless we have some type of relationship. Well, these data brokers are a little bit different. They can sell sometimes very similar information to anyone. They don't have to tell you about it. They don't have to give you access to your data, although some do. And what's interesting is that a single a company may perform all three of these functions now. For instance, ChoicePoint is the company I want to talk about later. They have a very big marketing operation. About 20% of their business is for target marketing. So you can go to ChoicePoint.com and, for instance, buy a list of people who have some attribute, who have a certain type of car or a certain level of income. They sell consumer reports. In fact, about 70% of salaried jobs now have background checks. And if you go into one of these jobs, it's very likely that ChoicePoint will perform your background check. If you become a volunteer, any type of volunteer activity where you are caring for the vulnerable or children will often result in a ChoicePoint report being run on you, which is an interesting thing to have happened. And finally, data brokers sell information to private investigators, law enforcement, businesses, and all sorts of other people under a kind of a rubric of needing this data for risk management. So there's all sorts of people out there who can buy this information about you. Now, back in 1999, we did a lot of work on these companies. And one of the reasons why we're talking about them again today is that these companies have had significant security problems in recent years. And so we've been able to put the issue back on the radar. But back in 1999, when we were almost able to get this industry regulated, the data brokers formed something called the IRSG. It was their basically lobbying group to blunt off legislation. And I'm not asking you to read this. I think it's way too small. But you'll notice that they gave people a right to opt out. They said, they said to Congress that, don't come after us. Don't pass a bill regulating us. We're still an evolving series of companies. So, and what we're going to do is we're going to let people opt out of our data sale. But if you read the fine print, it says you can opt out of non-public information distributed to the general public. Now, the next paragraph here says ChoicePoint limits access to its information to government and businesses that have legitimate business purposes for the sale. Therefore, they're not members of the general public. Therefore, you have no right to opt out. So we gave you that right to opt out, but it doesn't apply to any of our businesses. And this is how they escaped regulation back in 1999, and they were able to dupe Congress. So why should you care? You should care because the data in these reports are really detailed, and these are not always easy to read. So I'm going to explain them. This is actually portions from my Choice Point report that I pulled a couple years ago, and I'm not going to show you the whole thing because some of it is private, frankly. Choice Point reports were, a lot of these products were first made for debt collectors. The idea is that they wanted to have all the information about you they could, all the context about you they could, so they could track you down if you were a deadbeat. And over the years, it's been found that this information is very useful for other purposes. So if you order your Choice Point report, and the way you can do it, you can actually get your Choice Point report free now if you go online to choicetrust.com. There are four different reports offered there that you can get free. Be sure to ask for all four. They're free. You can do that now. This is the public records report. It starts out with what's known as a credit header. Credit headers are identification information from the top of your credit report. And generally, this is the best way to locate someone. Because when you move, you might not go get a new driver's license. You might, deal with that later. You might not do the standard things that you're supposed to do when you move. But you almost always update your bank account information and your credit card information. And whenever you do that, it triggers the creation of a new header. And so these are all the headers that had been generated on me. And you can see where I lived in Athens. You can see I lived in Virginia for a little while. And then I lived in Washington, D.C. And this really is the best way to locate someone. And when people are rather shocked when they do get their Choice Point reports, because these headers will go back 30 or 40 years. In fact, if you ever need on an application to fill out where you've lived in your life, it's great to pull one of these reports because they know, even if you've forgotten. So date of birth, my phone numbers, the fact that I'm male, although I have some friends whose reports identify them as female. There's also a social security number in there I've blanked out. The next portion of the report talks about property attributes. So it's going to list all the properties where you've owned and that you've owned over the years, if you had some interest over the years. And this is my apartment in Athens, and you'll notice that it says alert, the following high-risk addresses matched your subject's address history. So the company is sophisticated enough to know that my address in Athens was actually a high-risk address because there was a nightclub in the basement. So that type of information is really useful for insurance companies who are trying to underwrite you. There's motor vehicle records in there. Now I've blanked this one out because it's rather invasive. In fact, in my report, not only is my car in there, the car that is owned by the tenants of my Athens house is in there. And I actually don't even know who they are. I've never met them or anything. But I know that they own a Camaro, and I know their driver's license number, and I know the license number of their car, and I know the VIN number of their car. Now, what business do I have to know that information? It doesn't really matter because this information can be sold, and it's hard to limit. The other interesting thing about Choice Point reports is there's information about your family, and I've cut this out as well. But it's basically all the addresses of all my brothers, my parents, and some of my extended family. What's also interesting about Choice Point reports is that they will link you to your previous roommates, and there is one. There is one person whom I used to live with in my report where Choice Point has given me the information of her current roommates. So not only do I have her information, I have the information of strangers, girls I do not know, who currently live with her, the cars they drive, their driver's license numbers, and their plate numbers. All of this for sale. There's also information on all my neighbors. I've blanked out as well, but I actually finally figured out who all my neighbors were when I ordered this report. And it's also a little creepy because I also have information about all their cars. Yes, sir.
How long is this report?
I'm 31 years old. I requested this when I was 27, and my report was 30 pages. Yeah, and if you are older, the report gets much longer. And I'd encourage you to request your report, because you can do it free now. And you actually you have to download an application and fill it out by hand and mail it in. It comes about 10 days later, and it's called the Public Records Report, available at choicetrust.net.
Are they required to give that to you free?
No, they are not. ChoicePoint is now giving this report free. I had to pay $20 to get mine. It is now free because Congress is breathing down their necks, and it is very likely the Congress will pass a bill to address this company this year. Yes, sir. Yeah, it's really weird. The website of the company is choicepoint.com, but if you want your reports, you go to choicetrust.com. I don't know why, but that's yeah.
Maybe to avoid giving it out. I mean, so it's you don't even see it normally on their main website.
Yeah, I don't know if there's links to it. You know, these things can change overnight, of course. And so I have information about all my neighbors' vehicles, and these are some of them. What's also interesting is when you look at ChoicePoint reports, you realize where the data come from. The data are not coming from customer sales records. They're not coming from warranty cards. They're not coming from grocery cards. They're coming from public records. These are some of the databases that are searched in a routine ChoicePoint. And you'll see bankruptcy files from all the states I've lived, corporate records. You can see that they have information on watercraft and aircraft, all sorts of public records that one triggers in living. And so then the obvious question is how are the data used? Well, ChoicePoint, to understand that, you really need to know a little bit about ChoicePoint. ChoicePoint is actually a spinoff from a consumer reporting agency called Equifax. There are three large consumer reporting agencies in the US. ChoicePoint started up with Equifax years ago. And did risk management and identification. And back in 1997, Equifax spun it off. And there's a filing of the Securities Exchange Corporation discussing why they spun it off. And they basically said that mounting public pressure about privacy caused Equifax to spin off the company on its own, in part because they didn't want to deal with the negative publicity associated with a consumer reporting agency selling this type of data outside the statutes that normally regulate the industry. ChoicePoint did $980 million in revenue last year. And they have an incredible network of information collection. They claim to obtain 40,000 records a day, and they say that their entire database includes 19 billion public records. Now, the way they collect the data, several different ways. One is they literally go into the DMVs and to other entities and say, give us the tape. Just give us all the data. We'll pay you for the media. And you'd be surprised, because courthouses and DMVs, they sell that data for almost nothing. And the case I'm working on in Florida, the driving records of 4.3 million Florida residents were sold to a data broker called Axiom for a penny each. So that is how little your data is worth to the government. They just kind of hand it over. What's also interesting, they do standard screen scrapes. They have systems that go out to websites and grab data off websites. But what's most interesting is that they actually send out canvassers. They send out people who go out to police departments and to to courthouses, who actually write down the records by hand every day. And if you go to your local police office, I was in the DC police station not too long ago, and next to me were two men dutifully copying down every arrest record that had been filed the night before. And that data goes into the system, and it ends up in your employment background check, and it ends up in marketing reports that are sold to attorneys, et cetera. It's really an amazing chain, the way it all works. Over the years, and I have to apologize for my slides. My slides suck. I don't really like PowerPoint. But these are all the companies ChoicePoint has acquired, 50 companies since 1997. Yes, sir.
Is there no other way you can get it besides having people hand copy criminal records? I mean, is that the only access? And it sounds like it'd be terribly expensive going to collect all of this, too.
I was surprised when I first started working on these issues. I was really surprised that the data came in by hand. Because you have transcription error issues, and then the errors can be magnified when you put them into the computer, right? Because they're not getting scanned in. In some in some places, the companies do have scanners. They will bring a portable scanner into the courthouse and scan it in. But you still have a level of transcription there that has to be dealt with. And there are really amazing cases where there have been errors in the transcription resulting in people's records being messed up. There is the Scott Lewis case. This is a guy, I think, actually worked for Hilton Hotels, actually. We're in the Hyatt now, though. Because of a transcription error, a murder conviction was added to his record. And it took him a long time to figure out why he couldn't get a job. And one of the reasons why is that companies were pulling these reports and not telling him, because they had no duty to. And he ended up losing his job for something that he never did. So if you look at the various companies that are in the acquisition here, you'll see a lot of them are drug testing. A lot of them are also DNA, fingerprinting. There's some really interesting companies in here, including a company that will take your driver's license. And if you go to certain rental car companies, you'll find the system. They take your driver's license, and they put it in a machine, and they scan it. And they lift your picture and any information they can off your driver's license, and they send it to ChoicePoint. And ChoicePoint mashes it against their database. And if the data don't match, they say, don't rent that car to that person. That's probably a fake driver's license. Well, what they also do is they keep that driver's license. They keep your image and all that information on you. And so one of the important privacy tips I'm going to talk about tomorrow is that you have to watch out for businesses that are swiping your driver's license. Because except in California, when a company swipes your driver's license, they're allowed to keep all the data encoded on it. And what the DMV isn't telling you is that there's actually information encoded on your driver's license that doesn't appear on the face of the card. So for instance, your social security number might be in the barcode and not appear, not the barcode, but the magnetic script, and not appear on the face of your license. So you could inadvertently be handing over your social security number and other information to companies. And then once they have it, they can do whatever they want with it. A lot of the data from ChoicePoint gets sold to the government. Credit headers, as we discussed before, are sold to the government. They're used for locating people. And in fact, the government has all sorts of amazing systems that they can use as a result of these. Yes, sir?
Bridger Systems, the last slide, is a Patriot Act compliance company.
Yeah.
I know the Patriot Act is Biden. It was not aware there's companies that are considered compliance companies for the Patriot Act. Remember, like the fourth down, Bridger?
Yeah, Bridger.
What do they, could you talk about a little bit about them or what they
sure.
do?
Sure. You know, one of the results of the USA Patriot Act that wasn't discussed much outside in like the liberal civil libertarian circles, but more in the kind of the right wing civil libertarian circles, like the Cato group, the Cato Society, and some of the libertarian groups, was that the Patriot Act introduced something that's known as know your customer rules at banks. And so all financial institutions, that includes credit card companies and a whole lot of other companies now, department stores, for instance, issue credit cards, they are required to know you when you apply for a new account, meaning they have to get your identification card. They need a passport or a driver's license, something similar. They have to, by law, collect your social security number and your date of birth. Now, what do you do with that data? Well, as a result of the Patriot Act, you take that data and you smash it against some terrorist screening databases. And one of the big ones is known as the SDN database, is the database administered by the Department of Treasury. It's incredibly huge. I have some friends who actually work on it. It is a list of people that, as an American, you are not allowed to do business with. So when you go apply for, let's say, a credit card, you know, even at, like, let's say Nordstrom's, they take this information from you. And then a company like Bridger helps Nordstrom's match your data against this incredibly sophisticated database. And the reason why it's so sophisticated is that some people are in there by their first names only, okay? This is a list, it's comma delimited, and it's 120 pages long. You can actually download it on the internet. And the idea is that these people are known for drug running or for terrorism, and you cannot do business with them as an American. And there are penalties for doing so. And it, the list is actually kind of funny in that there are people identified by the first name. So there are people like there's Ahmed, the Egyptian. You'll find that in the database. And because there's another Ahmed that's not Egyptian in the database as well. Companies like Bridger are brought in to help the companies issue you credit and make sure that they're not giving a credit card to Akmar, the Egyptian. Yes, sir.
So when, you know, obviously in the course of a normal business day, 25 to 100 Akmars, you know, are challenged to challenge the database,
yep.
What's the next column they look at to make sure he is not Akmar, Egyptian?
That is the issue that is plaguing financial services in America right now.
There is no default column.
There's name and whatever identification information they have. So for some people, like you or me, if you or I were landed on this database, they'd have our date of birth and they'd have other information about us. We'd be identified pretty specifically. But some people are not identified specifically. And then you have to do extra due diligence. You have to do extra evaluations. And so there are big banks in America. We have banks with millions and millions of customers, they matched their customer list against the SDN and they came back with thousands of matches. And most of them were false positives. Most of them were not the people, the actual people on the list. And it cost them an incredible amount of money to deal with that, to do the due diligence of investigating who is on the list and who is not. So it's a significant problem for business. Yes, sir.
There is one thing with that. I know a lot of times, a lot of credit unions at least do not update that database for about once a month, just as a time frame. Because I actually worked in credit union previously, we pulled it. First of every month, they pulled it. Most time, there was nothing new.
Yeah.
But you would have, most of the time, if you were on the list by accident for some same reason, it could be 30 days before your name was off the list or the list was changed.
And so, what happened to the people on that 30 days?
Starvation.
Sorry.
I think in the 2 or so years or 3 years that we have been doing that, it was, I think it had 1 or 2 false positives on it. Out of everybody that was new coming in for membership. Other than that, basically we could run it against like check systems or anything like that. It was pretty much, sorry, we can't really do much for you.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and I'm not sure how you get your name off that system. Yes, sir, do you have a question?
I was wondering, some of us belong to organizations where we take a different name, like the SCA. I was known as Francesco Alberti. Would that
mean that? The SDN is a database that you're not likely to be placed in for kind of political activities. Yeah. Most of the people in it are drug runners. However, there are people identified as terrorist financiers that'll be in there. I've never seen an example of being a member of a group landing you in the SDN. It might land you in other police databases, but the SDN is actually pretty public. In fact, it's almost a little silly, because if you're on it, you probably know about it. let me talk about some of the other services sold to government. Okay, so we talked about credit headers, and new credit headers are generated every time you open up a bank account, a credit account, or you change your address. Let's say you move and you tell Visa. Law enforcement now has systems where they can say, if we want Scott Jones, they can put a little search feature in there saying, as soon as any new information comes in on Scott Jones, send us an email, and we'll send out the Marshal Service to go arrest them. And actually, you can find lots of people this way. You can find lots of fugitives from justice. There's all sorts of background screening tools that are used by the government that are sold by companies like ChoicePoint. Asset location services are really big, and the previous speaker was talking about fairness of taxes. Well, who's one of the biggest subscribers to this service? It's actually the tax collection agencies all across America. that use these services, because they can figure out what type of property you own, whether you're a corporate officer, a lot of other things about you. There's Soundex, but that's pretty basic. And of course, information on neighbors and family members. So you can usually track someone down. The idea is, if someone's on the run, you can get this list of people, everyone they've ever lived with, and all of their family members, and you go knock on all their doors trying to find the fugitive. The standard report sold to law enforcement is called the AutoTrack XP report. It used to be that you could buy this report on yourself, but it doesn't appear as though the company is still selling it. The report I was showing you earlier is an AutoTrack XP report. And finally, data broker files are sold to many other people. The same file that I showed you earlier are sold to attorneys. You know, one of the things attorneys do before they take a case is they will run a choice point report on someone and figure out whether or not they have money. Sometimes they run them on their own clients to make sure their clients have enough money to pay them. Private investigators are big buyers of AutoTrack XP reports. Yes, sir.
This argues that you really don't have to be any of those. Anybody can buy a report.
Well, it's a little bit more difficult to buy a report from ChoicePoint than just a couple years ago. It used to be if you had a business license, you could sign up and become a buyer. They're a lot more careful on how they sell this data. But one of the problems that remains is that ChoicePoint is not the only data broker. And what's happened is that the people kind of on the edge, the people who probably shouldn't be getting this information, are now using other services. One of them is called Merlin. Merlin it's got a lower threshold for becoming a customer. The other one is called Tracers Info. So, you know, you can go to those websites and they'll generally sell to the public.
And how much are those generally?
Sorry?
Oh,
well, it depends on how many reports you buy, but if you're just buying a single report, $15 or $20. And so, it's a real problem because people will buy them on people they're dating, daughters, you know, boyfriends, etc. Businesses are big buyers of choice points and reports. Yes, sir?
So, it seems like really the big problem isn't just regulating choice point, but anybody who's subject to an ethics or security violation down the chain.
Yeah, you know, that is a very hard question to answer because the regulatory environment has become very complex. What we're trying to do is bring these reports under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And the reason why is that the Fair Credit Reporting Act basically says that you can't buy a report for no reason. You have to have some relationship with the data subject. You got to be giving them credit. You got to be hiring them. It can be that you're investigating them. For instance, if you are actually suing them, that is a pretense that could get you a credit report. But currently, that link isn't there. If these reports are under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, there are restrictions on reuse and resale of the data. And there are also duties to destroy the data. It's actually Georgia is the first state in the nation to do something about this. Back in 2002, Georgia passed a law that said that if you are collecting Social Security numbers or in your business or driver's license numbers, when it's time to throw away your disk drives or your paper records, you have to shred them. That law was such a good idea that it's actually adopted on the federal level now. And so if you're a buyer of credit reports, even if you're a landlord who only rents one unit, okay, and you're pulling a credit report on your tenant, you are required to shred that data. And we think that's the right thing to do because otherwise they're getting tossed in the trash. Your question is really hard to answer. You know, in California, the answer is completely different. In California, there are all sorts of obligations that exist. So if you buy a report like this and then accidentally throw it away or allow someone to take it from you, you're required under California law to actually call up the data subject and tell them that their personal information has been stolen. And if you don't, the data subject can sue you if they ever figure it out. So the regulatory environment is complex, and we're trying to bring it under a standard system of the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And finally, debt collectors, of course, use this data. I kind of wanted to, you have a lot of questions, and I really like that. This is great, and I hope you can come by tomorrow because I can really talk in detail how to protect yourself more generally if you're interested in flying below the radar. But I did want to conclude by talking about the different ways you might stay out of these databases if you care. Some people don't care. I was sitting in the airport lounge this morning with a guy who basically says, I think the government should be able to do whatever they want. Well, that's fine. If you don't believe that, follow my advice. the key rule in privacy generally is minimization. And this is the idea that you shouldn't share personal information unless it's necessary. And when you do share the minimum necessary. So you only release personal information when you have to. And a lot of, you can apply this rule in a lot of contexts. You go to the Sports Authority. Anybody here go to the Sports Authority? Sports Authority collects your telephone number at the cash register. Why do they do that, you think? Telemarketing. And there's actually two different things they're doing. Sports Authority is involved in a class action lawsuit in Florida where they collected phone numbers from people at the register and started calling them. But they call them with a computer. And they, instead of saying, hi, this is Chris from Sports Authority, they actually call them with a computer with a pre-recorded voice. So you start getting telemarketing from a company, and it's a computer, so you can't say buzz off or otherwise retaliate. And not only that, there is an exception to the do not call registry. So even if you're on the do not call registry, if you give out your phone number, they can call you. So don't give it out. You don't need to. And there's lots of ways of doing this. You can say no if you don't want to. If you're not a confrontational person, just say 555-1212. You'd be surprised how many people don't pick up on that. Other advice is don't fill out warranty cards, customer surveys, or sweepstakes. These are all devices to collect personal information. And I have tons of information about this on my website at epic.org, where we can kind of show you the links between filling out a sweepstakes form at the mall and then you getting telemarketing or junk mail that you may or may not. Maybe you don't care. If you resist a little, most businesses will give you what you want. So if you know, for instance, Sports Authority is not going to turn down the sale because you refuse to give your phone number. In fact, there's some companies that have gone the other way on data collection. For instance, Radio Shack doesn't. You notice you go to Radio Shack now; they don't ask you your name and home address anymore when you buy a transistor. They actually ended that because people complained. And so it is useful to complain. And then, of course, one of the problems with privacy is that sometimes you have to vote with your feet. Sometimes you have to say, I'm not going to buy what you're selling because you won't let me get it in a privacy-friendly term. So a good example is Blockbuster. You know, if you go to Blockbuster, unlike independent video rental stores, they require your social security number for a lot of different accounts. And it was because Blockbuster did this to a congressman, Representative Clay Shaw from Florida, a Republican and chairman of the Social Security Committee, that that practice probably will end because he was asked for his SSN to, you know, to rent a $10 video and objected, and he had to leave. Blockbuster wouldn't give him. The key to protecting your privacy when it comes to data brokers is, of course, limiting disclosure of your SSN. You really shouldn't give away your SSN because whenever you give it out, it triggers the creation of one of those credit headers, one of those address location pieces of information I showed you earlier. And so there are some situations where you do have to give away your SSN. And I don't think my list is comprehensive. It's kind of hard to think through all of it. One is when you're interacting with the government. However, when the government asks for your social security number, they are supposed to give you a disclosure, what's known as a Section 7 disclosure. So when you go to the DMV, you should get a piece of paper that says, we require your SSN in order to give you a driver's license. It's actually required by federal law. Of course, when you do your taxes, you have to give your SSN. Because of the Patriot Act, whenever you apply for a financial account, and that also means a credit card, you have to give your SSN, otherwise you don't get the card. That's a requirement of federal law. And finally, when you apply for employment, you usually have to give your SSN. However, a lot of employers will let you interview And so you can go through the interview process, and if you're actually hired, then you can give your SSN. And that's one way of limiting your exposure. And of course, one of the big tricks is keeping your SSN out of your wallet. You'll notice that if you have Blue Cross Blue Shield insurance, if you went to University of Georgia, you will look at your identity card and you'll see that it is your social security number that is on your card. Now the problem there is if you lose your wallet, there are several different things that can happen to you. One is if someone runs away with your credit cards, charges up a bunch of stuff, you don't have to worry about that too much because you can cancel those cards and you're not liable for the charges so long as you report them in a timely fashion. However, if someone gets your wallet, they get your driver's license, you know, they got your name and your address, and they also have your social security number, they can apply for new credit cards in your name. And those are much harder to discover. And chances are you'll discover them when a collection agency calls you up and says, why are you a deadbeat? Why are you not paying this credit card? And then you'll realize that your identity has been stolen and someone used your social security number to get new credits. So that's one of the most important issues. Another rather kind of painful reality, yes, sir.
A lot of this is talking about trying not to let your information get out there. It's too late. Your information is out there if you exist in this society. We can't actually stop it, being that it's too late. What we have to do is address it as EPIC is designed to do by promulgating new public policy. The key thing, which I wonder if EPIC is working on, is stopping the simple knowledge of a social security number from being any kind of belief in your possession of the identity. In other words, a social security number is a user ID. It should never be used as a password.
I need to hire you. Okay, because you're getting
away, you'll have to take me away from Delta Airlines where I report to the CISO.
Okay.
But if you can
yeah.
pay me enough.
You got it right on. For a lot of us, it is too late. But the one of the points of privacy law, and I'm going to conclude with a couple ideas for laws, is that it protects younger people. And I'll give you an example. The Driver's Privacy Protection Act of 1998 requires DMVs to obtain your consent before they sell your information. Now, that law didn't take place until 1998. So you and I, our data has already been sold. It's too late for us. However, it's going to work for our children, it's going to work for our younger brothers and sisters. And what privacy law does is prune off these different sources of information. A good example is Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act of 1999, is very weak financial services privacy law that I worked a lot on. But one of the things it did is it stopped credit reporting agencies from selling social security numbers. You know, in the United States, it is not illegal to sell a social security number. I can buy your social security number and sell it to someone else if I want to. But that law stopped the biggest sellers of SSNs from continuing to do it. And it was litigated, it was upheld in the D.C. Circuit. So, I mean, as to your first point, is it too late? It is too late for some of us. But some of these approaches will reduce your footprint in the databases, if you will. You will be less likely for all of your information to show up. As to the second point, I am working on a petition under Gramm-Leach-Bliley, under a federal financial services law, that would make it an unfair or deceptive practice to require the SSN for authentication. That is, use of the SSN as a password. We have this, you know, bizarre problem where there are some businesses out there that use the SSN to identify you, and then some businesses that use it as a password. And then some businesses that use it as both. And it doesn't make any sense. And we have to kind of move beyond that. And so we are working on the regulatory front to deal with that, the problem you raise. Yes, sir?
Just to make sure that the language that you're proposing in this petition accomplishes the intended result, it isn't whether they can require the SSN in order to apply for or to grant you credit, it is that they must be prohibited from considering it sufficient as an authenticator. In fact, because it is out there and everyone has one and it's already commonly used, it would be Pyrrhic to try and block people from asking for it. What's necessary is to block them from considering it sufficient.
Yeah, in California, we've actually taken both approaches. So in California, for instance, it is illegal to condition the provision of products or services on disclosure of the SSN. Blockbuster can't ask for your SSN.
So how do they check your creditworthiness to get an account with them?
They bootstrap it through a credit card. You give them a credit card number. The second avenue there is, at least in California, when you apply for instant credit, the Social Security number alone cannot be used as a password. You have to have the SSN plus two other identifiers, at least. Now, you're looking not happy. That's the best we could do, okay? Because we had a lot of opposition to that law. Yes, sir.
So sort of flip that question around, is there anything being done to help the individual authenticate people who are asking us for our personal information? Is there any kind of challenge response or some sort of thing that where I can verify that someone who's asking for my SSN or any other personal information to do these things should be authorized to have it? For instance, if it's for credit, okay, well, if I'm renting an appliance, does that qualify as credit, and should I give them my SSN or whatever they ask for?
That is a really good question. And the general advice that consumer advocates will give you is that you should never give your SSN where you didn't initiate the telephone call or you didn't initiate the contact. So if the phone rings and they say, this is Citibank and there's been this tremendous privacy breach, we need your SSN to verify something, hang up on them, and then call them back. You know, get the number off the back of your Citibank card, call them back and say, hey, did you really do this? There is an incredible amount of social engineering and what's known as pretext calling, where people will call you up and pretend to have authority to ask you for something when they really don't. Now, there's a more nuanced...
Yes, exactly.
And there's a more nuanced problem, and that is, well, what do you do when it's a legitimate business asking for your Social Security number? How do you know? Well, they're free to ask for it, right? In all states except California, they're free to ask for it. So how do you distinguish? One good rule is credit, and the problem there is that a lot of different things are credit. You rent the washer and dryer from the rent-to-own, that's credit. You establish utilities, power, phone bill, that is credit. So there are all these different contexts in which you have to give your SSN. The only way to avoid that is to pay a deposit. So a lot of states will require utilities to say, in lieu of the SSN, the citizen can provide a $50 or $100 deposit. Of course, how does that help people of low income? Doesn't. So one of the problems with privacy is if you're really serious about it and you really want to protect it, you have to accept some inconvenience, and in some cases you have to pay some money. I recently moved to California, for instance, and established my phone and electric service in false names by paying deposits, and I'll just pay by cashier's check.
Have you violated Patriot?
I hope not. yes, sir.
You mentioned that for many of us, we're in databases already. For telemarketers, you have ways to take yourself off of their lists with a no-call provision. Are there ways to get out of these databases?
Well, the most, there's no way to completely extricate yourself, but you can kind of leaving a lighter footprint, if you will.
That's your new information. What about for old information?
The old information they're allowed to keep until we can pass a law that creates a data disposal rule. One of the reasons why we want to bring these companies under the Fair Credit Reporting Act is that under that consumer law, negative information about you has to be erased from your record after 7 years. So you can have social forgiveness, if you will. You know, you can kind of get over bad things from your past. But in the current regulatory state, if you have an arrest record from when you were 18, it stays in there. And it can follow you for the rest of your life. And so part of what we're trying to do is create a better bargain for people. It's, you know, an ability to kind of start over again after a certain amount of time. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I assume since the data brokers are unregulated, there's no provision for correction of bad information, wrong information.
You are correct about that. Now, we worked on a bill in California known as SB 550, was actually killed by the data brokers. They sent in their corporate counsel. In addition to their local lobbyists, they sent in their corporate lobbyists, which is always a sign that they're worried when people start flying in. The bill we are working on would have done three things. One is it would give you a free copy of all your data broker reports. So it wouldn't be just ChoicePoint, but also Axiom, LexisNexis, Merlin, Tracers, all these other companies that no one's ever heard of. It would give you a right of correction. So if the data were wrong, you could do something about that. And then finally, it would give you an audit trail. You could see the names of all the people who bought your report and why. And it was that last right. You know, they weren't so concerned about correction, interestingly enough, because they already deal with it. They have infrastructure to deal with the correction problem. It was that third aspect, the audit trail that they objected to so strenuously.
Those people ought to have a right to privacy.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. In fact, I'm working on a case right now in California, where a consumer has sued Pioneer Electronics, and he alleged that the Pioneer Electronics made a DVD player that did not work. And in the course of this litigation, he learns that 700 other people had written letters to Pioneer to say that the DVD player doesn't work. And so the plaintiff wants their names. He wants to start a class action. You definitely have numerosity with 700 people. You know, Pioneer objected to the release of personal information, saying that they were protecting the privacy rights of those 700 people who wrote in to complain about the DVD player, and in fact said that under the Constitution, they should have a level of due process that gives them notice and a right to opt in to having their data go to the plaintiff. Now, I actually agree with Pioneer. I actually believe that, you know, that there's a way to do this that respects privacy, but it's not often that you see businesses like privacy when it hides certain things. It's a problem with privacy. It really, so
double standard.
Yeah. One of the keys to having a lighter footprint in these databases is to try to stay out of public records, which means that you can't always enjoy the things that you might want to enjoy in life. And so I don't even recommend that you do this. I only recommend you do this if you're really serious and you don't want to be in these databases. And so this is really drastic, but if you want to stay out of the database, you have to do things like not get married in the United States or not own property. You know, if you're a renter, you have a lot more privacy than a homeowner, unless you're willing to buy your home with a trust. There, you know, you have to engage in these amazing acrobatics to hide. And I actually don't even recommend that you do it. But we really need to kind of balance, as you said, I think it, in order to balance out people's rights, we really think there should be a law. And so the law we're seeking on a federal level would require all these companies to register at the Federal Trade Commission. And that way you could go to the Federal Trade Commission website and learn the names of all the companies and exercise your rights. You would get a free access to your report. You could correct errors, place some limits on the sale of data. You know, some of this data is legitimately sold. You know, the banks do need to verify your identity. There are some people who do need to investigate you, and so there are legitimate ways in which the data are used. But we think that the faucet is wide open right now, and it could be closed a little bit. And of course, we want to see who is buying the data and why. And of course, whether or not there are security breaches. And finally, you know, ChoicePoint, one of the things I love about ChoicePoint is they have all this PR out there. You go to their website, choicepoint.com, and you will find more pictures of children. It is so cute. They basically say that you need this data to be safer in this world. And you know what? That's true. To a large extent, it's true. Data is needed. But they're using these pictures as kind of a screen to use your data for all sorts of other purposes. You know, ChoicePoint sold the data of 140,000 people to a Nigerian criminal identity theft ring in California. That didn't help these people. So it's not this simple. And we've been trying to say that you know, we can have privacy and we can still have security, and the little puppy here will still lick this boy's face. And in fact, you know, their use of all these pictures has caused me to try to compete. And so this is going to be the new epic logo. You know, they have privacy, cats like privacy.
Is this ChoicePoint the same as the one who's in the insurance industry?
Yes. One of ChoicePoint's major products is known as the Clue Report. So if you and Clue, I mean, I don't want to go into this too deeply, but Clue is basically a report on all your property and all the claims you've ever made. So if you're in Louisiana right now, of course, you're going to be using Clue to as part of the administration to collect on your home that's been damaged. But one of the interesting things about Clue is it tracks not just your property, it tracks you. It tracks how many times you've made claims. And the other little secret about this is that if you, let's say you have an accident, let's say someone slips and falls into your house and you, and let's say they injured their ankle and you know, you're concerned and you want to cover their hospital bills. And so you call up your homeowner's insurance company and you say, you know, last night I feel terrible. My best friend slipped and fell and broke and hurt her ankle. I want to know whether or not I have coverage. Well, when you tell them that, they actually put it in the Clue database. And that counts against you. It shows that you are risky, that you've had an accident. So even if you don't, let's say even if you just paid your friend's hospital bill out of pocket, or let's say your friend wasn't injured and just didn't need anything after all, they still record that in Clue. Now you can request your Clue report. It's available at choicetrust.com and it's free. And you can request it once a year at no charge. It's a good idea to do. And for instance, if you're in the market for a new home, it's a good idea to buy a Clue on the new home to see whether or not it's been flooded or has other problems. Yes, sir.
In the list of things that you're proposing for the new protection laws, all of that is good and is necessary, but all of that is missing one more important item to try to push for. It'll be very, very hard to do because it actually raises the cost of every single business action that takes place on a record in these databases. It is to have a positive permission response from the person about whom the data is to be collected. So that if somebody wants to pull a hard hit on your credit report in order to check issuing a card to you, they cannot fulfill it until they send the request to you and you respond saying, yes, I asked for that. You may release the information. Or conversely, if some kind of federated identity scheme can be set up, that the request comes in with your authenticator on it, something that nobody is ever allowed to store except for the purpose of passing it through because you made the request.
That's a great idea, and you should know that I can't remember the exact number, but about 30 different states are considering a new consumer protection known as credit freeze. We've had it in California for several years. It's in Texas, it's in Louisiana,
and
Vermont.
What percentage of people in states that are eligible have exercised it?
Very small. And there's a couple reasons for this, and let me explain what freeze is first. I don't know whether or not you're getting freeze in Georgia, but there's a lot of states are going to have it as a result of this choice point breach. New Jersey, I think like 10 other states passed it this year. The idea behind credit freeze is that it's impossible to commit identity theft without a copy of your credit report. In every situation where someone is trying to get a credit card in your name or apply for credit in your name, the bank that is going to lend the money to the imposter pulls a credit report on the victim. And the idea behind credit freeze is that you make it so no one can request your credit report unless they have like a valid reason. For instance, if you're being sued or if you're a debtor, without you first unfreezing your credit report. So the way this would work is if you wanted to go buy the plasma screen at Best Buy this weekend, you would call up the credit reporting agency and you'd say, hi, I'm Chris, unfreeze my credit this weekend, I'm gonna go buy the TV. And then you could go to Best Buy and walk away with the TV, and then you could go refreeze your credit. Now, there are a couple problems with the system. In some states, only victims of identity theft can exercise freeze.
That's barn door after horses get out.
Yes, you're exactly right, because the whole point of a credit freeze is prophylactic. And the people who most benefit from it are children and the elderly, people who just don't apply for credit. However, become victims of identity theft. There are toddler identity theft cases in the United States now. And there are also, on the other end, there are elderly people are targeted for the crime. So the first problem is that in some states you have to be an identity theft victim. I think that's the case in Texas. In other states like California, you have to pay for the freeze. And you have to apply for it was certified mail. And, you know, that's a pain. No one wants to do that. And you have to pay $10 per credit reporting agency to freeze your credit. That's 30 bucks. No one wants to spend 30 bucks. However, there are model laws. The current model law is New Jersey, where you will be able to freeze for a minimum fee. Frankly, the companies have to build in the infrastructure. As you said, it adds cost. So there is going to be a fee associated with it. But the cool thing about the New Jersey law is that there are, the credit reporting agencies are required to unfreeze your credit in 15 minutes. So literally, you could go to Best Buy and on an impulse say, oh, you know, I do want that plasma call them up on the Best Buy telephone and say, unfreeze me. And you could buy your television or whatever you wanted to. And so that's the New Jersey law. And I think the governor signed it. So that's very close to what you're talking about. I don't think you're going to see it in Georgia. Freeze is a credit reporting agencies and the banks really don't like freeze. And they lobby against it very strenuously. Yes, sir. I don't think you've asked a question.
It seems like the new target would be, what information do you need to get the credit report unfrozen?
Yes.
That's what identity would go after next.
Yeah, you're right. And there are unbelievable, there are really cool things going on in customer authentication. That is, the proving you are who you say you are. You know, most people are used to authentication through the use of passwords, right? There are systems known as shared secrets, where when you open up an account with let's say a bank, you establish certain questions that the bank will ask you that you will remember, and it's unlikely that other people will know. So a shared secret might be, what was the name of your first pet? What was the name of the street that you were born on? These are things that other people aren't likely to know. They're not going to be in your choice point report, that's for sure. And chances are you're not going to forget them. So there are systems like that. There are all sorts of token systems that can be used. And currently, like for instance, in California, when you freeze, you get a letter in the mail with a password. And that password is what unfreezes you. So an identity thief would have to learn that. That's a pretty hard thing to do. But then what do you do when you lose the password? You know, you have to send another certified letter to the credit reporting agency. You can see how it can become inconvenient.
What about biometrics?
Biometrics are one way to do authentication. You know, the privacy community is generally not hot on biometrics for a number of reasons. And some of those reasons are legit, some of them aren't. Biometrics work really well in a small population. But there are problems on a large scale. People who are handicapped. Yes, sir? You're working on biometrics at Delta, I'm sure.
I'm an InfoSec engineer. Yeah, this is all my area.
Yeah.
Biometrics work very well even on large-scale populations as long as they are the authenticator, not the identifier.
Yeah.
In other words, if you walk up and I claim to be Jay Liebov and I put my finger on the reader, if I'm registered into that system before, there's an extremely high positive correlation rate to that finger imprint being mine or me not being who I claim to be. Where biometrics suck in large populations is all you have is the fingerprint and try and figure out who I am.
Yep.
Which is why facial recognition in the airports was an absolute disaster and fingerprints for opening doors worked very, very well. You do have to accommodate for where not everybody has the same fingerprint, the handicap being a very key one.
Sometimes manual laborers will not have fingerprints. Sometimes they get rubbed off literally from exposure to chemicals. The elderly tend to have lighter prints than the young people. It creates another problem, problems that possibly can be dealt with. But I think you're exactly right. I think one of the problems that we've seen with biometric implementation is that they've been used as a one-shot tool. So you go to, a supremely bad idea is to use biometrics as the payment identifier and authenticator at the grocery store. You go to the grocery store now. A lot of grocery stores have a system where all you do is put your thumbprint on there. And the basic problem is that it both identifies you and authenticates you. And I don't want to get too technical about this, but you want a token. You want something that can be revoked in this situation. If I am able to steal your thumbprint, and there's a number of ways in which I could do it, how can you stop me from charging your account? And the answer is you have to turn off your account. Now, when you use a system that has a token and the fingerprint, it's much better. So you slide your card, put down your fingerprint. are...
Password, fingerprint, voice recognition.
Yeah, because you can always change the password. But what we're seeing is kind of, is you know, what we're seeing is this
bad
other type.
Implementations of good technologies.
Exactly. Exactly. I think you're right. And then there are all sorts of other issues you have to deal with, whether the biometric will be used for some secondary purpose, whether, for instance, if you give your fingerprint to a third person, they can give it to whomever they please. So they can give it to law enforcement if they want to. Maybe you don't care, maybe you do.
That actually, there are existing and perfectly reliable technologies for dealing with that. The devil is in the details of every single contract between you and everyone you allow to collect your fingerprint. The answer is they're not allowed to collect your fingerprint, they're allowed to profile it and store only the profile. Profiles, hashes, technically,
right,
cannot be turned back into a usable fingerprint. It cannot be passed on to law enforcement.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And
who, of course, can get a warrant to break into your house and pick up a drinking glass off the shelf anyway.
Sure. And you know, a related area of privacy that I'm not really talking about today is that there's a 1976 case called United States versus Miller that really frames a lot of the law enforcement privacy challenges we face. And that law basically said that when you give your personal information to a third party, unless there's some contract there, that third party can just hand it over to law enforcement. And so one of the keys to protecting privacy is realizing that when you give your data out, your thumbprint, if you give the raw print, that third party can just hand it over. And you know, maybe you don't care, but a lot of people do. And it makes it inordinately easy for law enforcement to collect information on you. Yes, sir?
There was a case a month ago about a credit card company that they had sent a solicitation for a Muslim bomber.
Yeah.
And then he called them and they said, yes, Mr. Bomber, how can I help you? Was that as simple, do you think, as some irate neighbor sending them a credit card application, his name?
What
and
do
then,
you mean to a Muslim bomber?
To a just a random person, his name was like, you know, Randy Pierce or something normal like that. But the credit card application said Muslim Bomber.
That was the name written on the app?
Yeah, on the app, right, yeah. And when he called the credit card company, they said, yes, Mr. Bomber, how can I help you? Was that as simple as somebody that's like an irate neighbor or something sending a credit card interest letter to the company, do you think? Or how would that have...
Yeah, I'm familiar with this case, yeah. and it's kind of difficult to tell exactly what happened. But so some average Joe who happens to be, is he actually Palestinian?
I think he's not a WASP, but I don't think he's Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah.
I don't think he's Middle Eastern. I don't think.
So this was rather troubling to him. But he receives a credit card offer that's addressed to Palestinian Bomber. And so he calls up and the bank says, hello, Mr. Bomber. And so he wonders how this happened. It could happen in a number of different ways. It could have been poison. Sorry?
13 minutes.
Oh, thanks. Sorry. I'll speed up. It could have just been poisoning of a consumer database. And one of the things we've learned, or one of the things we think, is that credit card offers go out with no human intervention. And not only that, we think that credit cards themselves are issued without human intervention, meaning that the computers are issuing the cards. We have a lot of examples of cases where dogs get credit card offers, and then when you send in the offer, the dog gets the card. And there's this amazing case where this guy got a credit card offer for his dog, and he filled it out saying, you know, that it was his name was Mr. Dog, and that he worked at the Pupperoni factory, you know, this little.
Yeah.
And he wrote on the application, "This is a dog, you fool," or something like that. He sends it in, he gets the card. So it's one of the things we're looking at, because if the systems work like that, it's kind of obvious how identity theft can happen if the systems are that loose. But I'm not sure exactly how that guy got an offer addressed to Palestinian Bomber. It's
what does that say? I mean,
yeah. Well, the marketing databases, and you know, this is one of the issues I didn't address. But when you look at, you know, I talked about three different types of information collection. You have, you know, marketing, CRA, and then data broker. The consumer report data tends to be the most accurate. It's heavily regulated. It has to be accurate. In fact, if it isn't accurate, banks lose money. So there's money on the line. But the marketing information can be wildly inaccurate, because what they're doing is they're trying to increase response rates from 1% to 3%. So if you spend you know, a couple thousand dollars on a database to send out more marketing offers, and the number of responses you get increases just a little bit, it's considered a win, and it's okay to send out some that are in error or send out some that are an accident. And there are not privacy laws to address those practices. And of course, what we're trying to do at Epic is not get at junk mail, but rather get at the databases so that you have some ability to exercise your rights at that level. Yes, sir.
I was just curious, are there potential claims for bad information in these databases or the consequences of that bad information?
I was trying in the case of the guy who lost his job for being a felon that he wasn't.
That would be a case under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. I actually don't know what happened to him. Now, in the marketing context, I mean, I imagine your causes of action would be somewhere along something like defamation.
Or negligence.
Yeah.
But what's the damage if you receive a targeted marketing offer for which you're not really the targeted market?
You'd have to have damage. Consequences as this fellow who was identified as a...
So are you thinking of the marketing database or the...
Yeah, that guy definitely has a right of action.
I mean, you've got to prove how it caused the problem as well.
Well, the, you know...
If you could follow that chain, if you were having problems and you could identify bad data in databases that were provided to that prospective employer, for example, and they said, yeah, we looked at it and thought about it and that was a factor, could you go after choice?
You certainly could in the employment context. One concern that we have is whether or not these reports are being used in the employment context illegally, because technically, when you pull a report on someone, when you hire another person to investigate a job applicant, it triggers the Fair Credit Reporting Act. The problem is that employers don't always tell an employee that they're doing a background check. And in fact, you can do a background check on your own without telling the prospective employee. For instance, I could do a Google search. It's not against the law for me to do that. And if all sorts of slanderous information comes up, I might just not call you back. And I don't have to. I don't have to tell you that that's what I did.
There are things that you can't discriminate on in hiring. And if the Google search says you have 18 kids and I don't hire you for that,
yes,
I violated federal law.
That's exactly right. And that's why it's a bad idea to do that.
Yeah.
There are all sorts of pitfalls you can run into. For instance, if you do not hire someone, okay, this sounds completely rational, okay? If you do not hire someone because they have an arrest record, that actually can violate EEOC regulations. Because back in the 1970s, the EEOC ruled that an arrest record alone cannot be used in most hiring decisions.
Right?
Well, even conviction data, because criminal justice is so focused on minorities, it is a per se discriminatory practice. So you have to find a reason to hire someone, an independent reason. Now, of course, that rule is it's not a bright line rule. There's a lot of exceptions to that rule. You don't have to hire a bank robber at your bank, for instance. But if you are hiring someone to be a janitor and the only strike you have against them is a 10-year-old conviction, you could run into trouble for relying only on that data. So yeah, that type of landscape is really complex. Yes, sir.
I had a quick question about the legality of ChoicePoint keeping records on minors. For example, before 2000, when I was under 18, I subscribed to just about any online magazine possible, just because I could, you know, sign up for stuff and get PC Magazine, PC Gamer, any of these technical magazines for free, and they had, you know, page after page of, you know, marketing questions and stuff. What is the requirement of, what is their legal right to that information, being that at the time, I was under 18.
Pre-COPPA, post-COPPA?
COPPA, yeah, the relevant law would be the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, and that law has a couple limitations.
When did that come about, though?
1998. Okay. Now, the problem with COPPA is it only applies online, so if you did this offline, it doesn't count, and it only protects people under the age of 13. The definition of child under the statute is 12 and younger. And that law came about because there were all these different websites out there that would trick young people into providing personal financial information, even about their parents. So what they'd do is they'd set up a game that said the game would be, how much money does your family have? And you're supposed to put in, you know, my dad has stocks, my dad has bonds, and my dad's name is X and Y. And it was actually all a scheme to collect personal information about people through their children. And that practice is now legal. But it can be done offline. You could do that, and you'll find some retailers that market to what's known as tweens, the very young girls, will at point of sale ask questions about the parents. So to answer your question, though, there is no general law to address that type of information collection. In California, you have certain rights. For instance, in California, you can write to any business, and you can say, you can require that business to disclose to you how they have sold your information over the last 12 months. But California is the only law. Only. It's free game. That's one of the things with privacy law is that it will not retroactively protect data. So for instance, my social security number will forever be bought and sold because I was over 18 when the laws passed that protected that data, and so I'm out of luck. The other thing here is it's actually ChoicePoint is not likely to be the company that would have your data. It would be more likely to be companies like Experian, Polk, and Axiom that actually focus more on consumer profiling than selling information to the government. And so I'm running out of time. I have 5 minutes left. There's a question in the back.
No, it's not a question. I was just going to comment on, is it on? I was going to comment on minors. They actually ask at my daughter's school, at the beginning of the year, you can either opt out, but they can ask your children any information whatsoever at her school, you know, unless you opt out, and you actually have to put that in writing and everything too. So y'all may not be aware of it, but they're asking kids mm-hmm. all kinds of stuff just at schools too, not just at retail stores.
Part example of a question. Do you have a question? You know one? A question that they ask the child.
They can talk about, pretty much anything. They can take video, pictures, whatever, of your child.
I do know of one thing, though, is when I was in high school, they did ask, like, what is your average family income, some basic racial stuff, like, are you white, black, Hispanic? Of course, they already have most of that information in the database, but they didn't go into some of the specifics about family information, number of brothers and sisters.
I tell you, I have to stop. A man has come in with a gun and told us that we had to leave, and I'm going to take him seriously. Thank you, and I hope you come by tomorrow at 11:30.